Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to 2 Off the First. It is March the 16th, 2023. I'm Ryan Ballinger. Happy Stone Cold Steve Austin Day if you're celebrating. If you're not, then we've got plenty to talk about anyway. Obviously, there's plenty of reaction to the rollback news, the proposal from the USGA and the RNA that the way golf balls will be tested for, quote, elite competition is going to be under a different standard starting in 2026. And the reaction to that from tour players has generally been negative, at least the ones that have been in Tampa this week for the Valspar Championship. And we'll go through some of that. I think the biggest lightning rod for this is Justin Thomas. He put himself out there, basically regurgitated a lot of his equipment sponsor, Titleist, their parent company, Acushnet's talking points about this. And we'll go through those in some detail. And I think that and I tweeted about this yesterday, it seems like the general reaction here from tour players is that if you want to make golf harder, make setups harder. And we'll talk about that too. Maybe we'll put that on the back half of things. I think it's an interesting component of this to have because the way the PGA Tour has set up golf courses over the last really 20 years has changed a little bit. And there are reasons for that. There are reasons why they haven't lengthened courses as much. And so I want to kind of get into that a little bit. But I think we got to start with Justin Thomas. He was asked about this about mid-news conference yesterday ahead of the Valspar Championship, where he's the highest-ranked player in the field. And he's been very vocal. And he's not a fan of the USGA. There's no doubt he is not a fan of the USGA. He doesn't like them from a player relations perspective. He doesn't like them from an equipment regulation perspective. If you'll remember, 4 years ago, back during the kind of, oh, they don't treat us well enough and they don't pay us enough U.S. Open purse conversation, Justin Thomas was one of the leading proponents of being paid more to compete in the U.S. Open. And maybe to a degree he has a point or had a point at the time. But the USGA made it very public that they had reached out to Justin Thomas about having conversations and meetings and that he canceled on them frequently and that they were frustrated by his public comments, but he wasn't willing to have a private conversation with them to maybe perhaps better articulate and help the USGA understand his position about purses and player relations and stuff like that. And then Jason Gore comes in and now he's with the PGA Tour. So it feels like you need that as you need that as background. You need to know that Justin Thomas is not a fan of the USGA, and that's the place from where he starts. He also starts as a guy who has been a Titleist guy forever, and he is very happy regurgitating their talking points. And Acushnet put out their own statement, and it's a lengthy one, so I'm not going to read here. It would probably take me 10 minutes to read to you. But you can read it. I posted it on Twitter. You can check it out on their website. But the crux of their argument is that the phrase that they use, this is a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. And you will hear me say that phrase again when I quote Justin Thomas here, because he regurgitates it exactly. And Acushnet's belief is that golf is, quote, an aspirational game. And what they mean by that is not that it's something for rich people only in that context. They mean that they believe amateur players, recreational players, aspire to be as good as professionals and that they aspire to play the same equipment as professionals, even though they make their own tour formulations of golf balls and they keep various year models of their Pro V1 and Pro V1X balls available to players because the balls do change from cycle to cycle, 2 year cycles. And some players just prefer old ones, or they prefer the left dash or the left dot. And those are generally not available at retail. That's not to say that every player on the PGA Tour, the LPGA Tour, or any other major tour plays only those tour formulations. It's a small percentage. But other manufacturers also make tour-only balls because they need them to keep their staffers happy. So the idea that you are playing the same equipment every player on the PGA Tour or the LPGA Tour, DP World Tour plays is equivalent. I mean, it's a false equivalency. It's not true. It's never been true. It's not going to be true. And I think that kind of eats away at a lengthy statement from them. I understand they've also put tons of marketing dollars. I mean, generations worth of marketing dollars behind the idea of being the number one ball in golf, behind being the most popular golf ball among professionals. Now, you can get paid to play Titleist golf balls, right? And that certainly factors into their popularity because they have a very strong tour budget, tour-based marketing budget, where they can pay players to play their ball. And so then they can go to the Daryl survey, which takes a look at all the equipment players are playing. You go, well, Titleist is number one. I mean, they make a great product. I'm not saying they don't make a great product, but it doesn't hurt to have your pockets lined a little bit to make sure you play that ball. And that marketing is very important to them so that they can go to you and I and say, hey, you should play the same ball the pros play because we're the most popular, play Titleist. Now, I would argue it'd actually be way cheaper to go the route of working with amateurs and amateur influencers, and they do now with No Laying Up, to say, we make great products for everybody, and we can make a great product for everybody if this goes through. So it doesn't matter whether you're a pro, whether you're a recreational player, we make the best balls for you, period. End of story. And that would be a slight change in their marketing, but I don't think it would mean all that much. But again, Acushnet has been consistent as I have been for 20 years on this subject, and primarily because they're the ones with the best solid core golf ball. They're the ones that everyone kind of copied. I mean, I know Bridgestone came up with the solid core golf ball and slapped a Nike label on it for Tiger, but that notion that they have the best solid core golf ball, they've had this market position for 22 years, basically 23 years, and they don't want to give that up easily based on what they've done to cultivate that. And I get that, and you have to understand that financial motivation. Obviously, it's very clear. And you have a talking point for them. Well, why should we have to spend significant amounts of money to research and develop and produce a ball just for certain situations, whether that's for PGA Tour events or major championships? You could have specific Masters ball. You could have a specific U.S. Open ball. You could have a specific Open Championship ball. Those things are a possibility, I think, under this proposal. And there's also the realistic possibility that if the PGA Tour's board, and there are players on the board, so you would pretty much need the board's consent to do this, not a vote of the players, it's not how that works. But if the board says, you know what, we're not going to adopt this model local rule, well, now all of a sudden the PGA Tour finds itself in the equipment regulation game. And that is not an inexpensive thing. That means they've got to test player equipment. That means they've got to create their own standards. That means they've got to enforce them. That means for every piece of equipment that comes out, they have to test it, whether it's conforming or not to their standard. The USGA spends a lot of money doing that. And that is one of the things that they do on behalf of the game. If the PGA Tour and its membership are cool with that, then they could create their own standard. And there has been some talk about that from tour player reaction. But let's get into what Justin Thomas specifically has to say. And I think a lot of it was red herrings and stuff that really doesn't apply. So I want to kind of go over this as we go, offer a little bit of reaction in bits and pieces, instead of trying to read you 500, 600 words here, and then just kind of come back to it all. So let's take it in bits and pieces. So Justin Thomas starts off by saying, my reaction was disappointed and also not surprised, to be honest. I think the USGA over the years, in my eyes, it's harsh, but made some pretty selfish decisions. They definitely, in my mind, have done a lot of things that aren't for the betterment of the game, although they claim it. I've had conversations with some USGA members, and to me, I don't understand how it's growing the game. For them to say in the same sentence that golf in the best place it's ever been, everything is great, but, And I'm like, well, there shouldn't be a but. You're trying to create a solution for a problem that doesn't exist. That's the title's talking point, word for word. To me, it's so bad for the game of golf, for an opportunity. I mean, some of the great things to me is the fact that you can play the exact same golf ball that I play. I mean, that's cool. For an everyday amateur golfer, it's very unique that we are able to play the exact same equipment. Yeah, I understand that I may have a different grind on a wedge, whatever you want to call it, but you can go to the pro shop and buy the same golf ball that I play or Scottie Scheffler plays or whatever. Now, let's take those two paragraphs unto themselves. Of course, Justin Thomas isn't going to try to detail what he thinks that the USGA has done that's for the betterment of the game that isn't for the better of the game. The USGA does a lot of stuff that most people don't know about, and frankly, the USGA doesn't do the best job of talking about. They do a great job with agronomy research. They help research strains of grass. They preserve the history of the game. They test equipment at a standard for everybody. And no one was mad at the standard until they decided they wanted to change it. So they were fine with it until then. And that was the extent of it. Right? So I don't understand where Justin Thomas is coming from there. I feel like that line, all of that, is really just bupkis. It's just something made up to say he's got an issue with the USGA. His primary issue is that players who compete in the US Open don't get paid enough of the money from the rights fee that the USGA gets from his television partner. That's the beginning and the end of it. And that is okay to have that gripe, and that is a separate conversation. But to say that gripe turns into they just don't do things that grow the game, that's, yeah, no, not true. And that's okay, but coming from a position that he has a much larger microphone, obviously, than the USGA does. So he's just kind of making something up there. Now, for him to say, hey, it's cool that you can play the same equipment that they play. Again, that's largely true. I'm not saying that's not largely true. A lot of tour players play the off-the-shelf ball, whether that's the Pro V1s, whether that's TaylorMade's TP5s, whether that's Chrome Soft, whether that's Srixon's ball, I mean, you name it, you can do that. And I think there are a lot of golfers who would agree with that sentiment, that they think it's really cool that they could play the same golf ball. You're not going to play the same shaft, you're not going to play the same heads, you're not going to play the same grinds, because those are custom fit and those are custom made. But I think part of the argument that comes back is that, yes, they may not be the same from person to person, and they may be uniquely fit to these players, but they are to the same standard. And I think that's something worth looking at, and I think that's something worth talking about. I've been fine with bifurcation forever because the games that we play are not the same. The courses you and I play are not conditioned the same way that PGA Tour courses are, or LPGA Tour courses are. They're just not. And so the equipment is different too. We're not playing the same game. It's close, but it's not the same. It's like playing basketball on a 9-foot hoop versus a 10-foot hoop. Yeah, it's still the same sport. Or playing basketball with a high school ball or a middle school ball versus with a pro ball. Again, concept very similar, maybe not exactly the same, but it's about the same sport. But I have no, and I'm saying this as someone who hits the ball longer than 99% of golfers on the planet, I don't play the same game they play. They're just better at it. They do everything better. And so I don't think, oh, because I popped one today, I can be as good as they are, or that it really matters what they play. I play golf equipment because it works for me. And I'm also willing to play total rocks because I found them on the golf course that day. So I understand that argument. I don't completely agree with it, but I understand where he's coming from. Now, next couple paragraphs. The USGA wants to bring it to a point where that's not the case. They want it to be, well, the pros play this way and the amateurs play this way. And I don't understand how that's better for the game of golf. The amount of time, money that these manufacturers have spent trying to create the best product possible, and now you're going to tell them and us that we have to start over for potentially if the PGA Tour, PGA of America, don't adopt this local rule. So for the two of the four biggest events of the year, we're going to have to use a different ball. Like, try to explain to me how that's better for the game of golf. I don't understand how that's not better for the game of golf, honestly. If you're trying to create varying challenges, there are only so many things that you can do in golf, right? You can't control the weather. but you can control setup, and we'll come back to that in a little bit. But on the PGA Tour, they have come up with a way of setting up golf courses that they feel comfortable with, and they can use a variety of different factors to influence the outcome, so to speak, right? You can have different rough lengths, you can have different green speeds, you can have different strains of grass that you plant, the times of year that you play, overseed versus not. Think about the players. Different golf course in March versus May. You could have different heart firmness in bunkers. You could furrow rake the bunkers. You could make different green speeds. You can put pins in much different places. You could have accessible pins and very difficult pins. You can put them 6 from the edge and 3 from the edge and 2 from the edge and 10 from the edge and 10 on. And you can do all kinds of stuff like that. So that introducing a potential tournament golf ball, whether it's for one specific event or it's for just elite competition in general, and I think that's very much TBD, I think that's another tool that you can use for setup. Does that mean that's something players have to learn? Yes. But they also have to learn golf courses. So you're creating a different factor, a different thing to learn. And if you have those balls ahead of time, then you can learn them. I don't understand what's particularly difficult about that. And I don't think any amateur out there is thinking, well, I would really love to play the U.S. Open golf course. It's 7,350 yards. I'm just throwing a number out there. With really deep rough and super fast greens and unforgiving putting surfaces and all this. They don't want to do that. I've done it. I've played the U.S. Open setup on Sunday before. Not in the U.S. Open, obviously, but I played at Oakmont 2016. It's the hardest golf I've ever had to play. And I loved it, but not everyone's going to love that. And not many people want that. Thomas continues, they're basing it off the top 0.1% of all golfers. You know what I mean? I don't know many of y'all consistently play golf in here, but I promise none of you have come in from the golf course and said, you know, I'm hitting it so far and straight today that golf's just not fun anymore. Like, no, it's just not reality. I know I went on a little bit of a rant, but it irritates me because it's consistent with, I feel like, decisions and things the USGA has done in the past when it comes to rules and whatnot and data. I mean, what is it? Using 127 mile per hour clubhead speed? Like, if you can swing 127 miles an hour, power to you. I mean, people are running faster. So what are they going to make the length of a mile longer so that the fastest mile time doesn't change? Or are they going to put the NBA hoop at 13 feet because people can jump higher now? Like, no, it's evolution. We're athletes now. We're training to hit the ball further and faster. And if you can do it, good for you. So yeah, as you can tell, I'm clearly against it. Now, the back half of this is really, it's a red herring in some ways, because he's talking about the difference between athleticism and the evolution of biomechanics and study of how athletes perform versus the equipment. If you look at alpine skiing, if you look at track and field, actually has quite a bit of regulation about the kind of shoes that you can use and the way that they're designed and their weights and all kinds of facets of it. Swimming has that. They banned those swimsuits that were super fast and were crushing records because they realized the swimsuit offered a competitive advantage that in the past was not the case. And in the history of swimming, time is everything, right? That's the only thing. In baseball, they have like 3 different baseballs a season, it seems like, when they put them in humidors or not, when they want them to go far or not. They have moved back the 3-point line in the NBA. They have moved it back in college. They have changed that over the years because the way the game goes. You've seen offensive rules changed in the NFL and defensive rules change too. You've seen that in the NBA. You've changed where you can and can't stand to take a flop or take an offensive foul. All of these things are changed all the time because facets of the game change. So it's a false equivalency to say what he said there. But to his point, yes, I think pretty much everyone involved can recognize and appreciate that speed can be learned, that swinging hard can be a skill. Because you can train to get faster. You can train to be a better athlete. And I think for the generations before you could track all of this stuff with TrackMan and the research that you could put into the bodily performance that we didn't have when I was younger, you probably thought, hey, you're just born with it. Like, you've been given this muscle mass, you've been given these hands, you've been, you know, all this stuff, and you just have what you have. Well, that's not true. But you can learn to swing quicker. And Matt Fitzpatrick, the reigning U.S. Open champion, is a great example of that. And I don't think anyone is saying that that's not a skill. I really don't think that. So the pushback is, well, if you roll back the golf ball, and effectively they want to roll back 5%, right? I mean, we're not talking a lot here. But they're trying to roll it back 5%. Well, the impact of that will be greatest on the player who swings the fastest, because they get the most out of the golf ball because of this thing called smash factor, right? The conversion factor from club head speed to ball speed, which the most efficient is 1.52-ish, basically. And that smash factor, obviously, is a multiplier. So if you swing faster, then a rollback would impact you more. It's a sliding scale. So if you swing at 115 miles per hour with your club head, with your driver in this case, you're going to get less of an effect. But that's true across the board. It's also true that you can get more to a point out of a golf ball because you swing faster. So there is a point of diminishing returns as well. And we've seen that in long drive. When you get to a certain point of club head speed, getting close to maybe 146 and above in club head speed, you start to see a diminishing return on the golf ball. You don't get the same just upward motion of distance. So the yardage gain is harder to come by at about that club head speed because of the way the golf ball is designed under USGA rules, under what's called the coefficient of restitution, basically the amount of energy that is transferred from the club to the golf ball at rest. And at that point, you start to see that diminishing return. But up until that point, you kind of, it's not exponential, but you do get more benefit the faster you swing to an end, right? And so the going backwards obviously impacts the fastest swingers more, but they're still going to be the fastest swinger of the golf club. So they're still going to be the longest player. And I think that's one of those arguments that come back to from the anti-rollback side of, well, the longest players are still going to be the longest players. Or you might, or the false argument that Bryson DeChambeau offered, which is, well, they're just trying to make all of us more equal. That's not the case. That's not possible. That's physically impossible. It's not true. And Bryson is a faux scientist, so he doesn't understand that. But you're still going to be the fastest player. You're just not going to be able to impart as much distance on it from the club head. That they're not taking away the value of athleticism. They're just changing the frame in which that means. Now, goes into a next question, keeps talking about this, and he says, the question is asking whether he would prefer, Justin Thomas would prefer the tour, or keep the current equipment standard, even if that means there are a couple of events per year where you'd have to use a different ball. He says, I just think if it's going to come to this point, it's like, why are this group of, call it 5 to 15 handicapped amateurs, determining the rules of golf for professional golfers? Or why are they saying that we have to do something? So is it something where down the road where it's like, you know what, then fine. If you want to change something based off of your data that we feel like is pretty biased and incorrect and self-centered to what you believe in, then maybe we'll just create our own and do our own thing. I don't know where the tour stands on that. I can't speak on behalf of what they're planning on doing, but to my knowledge, they haven't necessarily been on board with it or wanting to pursue the rolling the ball back. I mean, I'm all for not letting it go any further. And I think this is another important thing. Like, this would help me. Rolling the ball back is only going to help, I feel like, somebody who hits it far and is a good ball striker. It's just an advantage for me, even more so, I feel like. And then I have, and I'm still not for it. It's the bigger picture. It's about the game of golf. If I can hear some reasons that claim it's better for the game of golf, then so be it. But I've yet to hear any. Now, of course, he's got his fingers in his ears. Don't want to hear anything. So that's okay. You can have your stance. That's totally fine. I think there is plenty of room in this conversation for disagreement. I absolutely believe that. But what really is annoying here is that Justin Thomas thinks, as because he is a professional golfer, he has a better understanding of equipment than people whose entire job it is to test equipment and to understand aerodynamics and physics and how all of this stuff works, and they test it, quite frankly, every day of their lives. And that's a stupid argument, and it makes him sound dumb. It's just the reality of it, because these folks are professionals. Like, I wouldn't ask Justin Thomas just because he loves, I don't know, fishing. I'm just making this up. To design for me a fishing rod. That would be silly, right? You wouldn't want that. I would want a professional who knows how to design fishing rods to come up with one for me if I want the best performance. Or if I want to understand which should or shouldn't be legal in a bass fishing competition, for example. I wouldn't turn to a fisherman for that. I would turn to someone who understands what the mechanics are, what the physics are, what materials are used, and I would turn to the fisherman for the technique. Just like I would turn to Justin Thomas for the technique of how to hit a rope draw, because he knows how to do that. But the folks at the USGA, they might be golfers, but they probably don't do that. So from an equipment standard standpoint, yeah, it makes sense. Now, if you're talking about just the rules of golf, maybe you've got something there, right? The folks who specialize in rules, who specialize in the history of the game, they're trained in it, they're professionals, they understand it. Does that mean that they completely sympathize or empathize with what professional golfers specifically might go through in tournaments? No, and I think you could probably see some cases there where you might have an issue. But think about being able to leave the flagstick in. I can understand that. But for him to kind of come out with this argument that the 5 to 15 handicapped amateurs are they're bumbling fools, and how do they get to make rules for us? That's not the case. So I just think it's very curious, the line of argument that he's going with here, basically going, these idiots don't know anything. Well, he's clearly proven he has a bias against the USGA, and he's kind of projecting that onto them by saying their numbers are biased and all that stuff. What I would encourage you to do is go read the Distance Insights report from 2022. It's very interesting to read. It's not very long. It's, I don't know, 15, 20 pages, something like that. A lot of it's just charts. Just see charts of distance from basically the turn of the millennium till now. And you can see for yourself some of the stuff they talk about. I don't think that data is biased. Now, you might think their conclusions are biased, but the data isn't. And the reason I can say that with a lot of confidence is the conversations I've had in private or public with people who have read these documents over the years, and they come to completely different conclusions than I do. So the data is there for the interpretation. I don't think they're out there trying to kind of present an argument that isn't true. Now, I know we're way deep on a normal length of this podcast, but I do want to come back to the point I brought up about PGA Tour setups. One of the counter arguments from folks who are anti-rollback is that they are not seeing big changes in the distance of golf courses on the PGA Tour week to week. The notion of, hey, the golf courses are only about 69 yards longer on average in a 15, 20 year period, whatever your frame of reference is. And there are some issues with that line of questioning or line of thinking. One, let's take TPC Sawgrass, for example, the home of the Players, PGA Tour's most important course that they own. That golf course has been lengthened about 400 yards in 25 years. Now, do they play that every day? No. And that goes to this point of setup. The PGA Tour is an entertainment product, in part. They are a serious entertainment product. And obviously, they very much value the heritage and history of the tour. But at the end of the day, they make choices about how to present a golf tournament, and they have a set of standards that they use, and they publish for all their players of how they want to set up golf courses, their philosophy around it. And their philosophy has changed over the years. In around the 2005, 2006, 07 timeframe, the PGA Tour started getting into more difficult setups. They grew the rough for a little while. Didn't seem to work. That kind of came on the heels of Vijay Singh bomb and gouge. That turned out to not be the trick. And they started putting pins in really crazy. Like, it used to be four off the edge was a crazy pin. Now it's like three. And that happens more frequently. It used to be maybe six or seven was like a medium pin. Now it's like four or five. So that happens more often. So their way of trying to challenge players is somewhat through length. And they can vary that setup from day to day. They also can change green speeds, and they can change hole locations. It can change angles. But they also recognize that people come to watch professional golf to be entertained. And their belief is that birdies and eagles are entertaining. And I think that there is a mixture of that. And I think Rory McIlroy talked about that a little bit after failing to win the Arnold Palmer Invitational, where he's like, well, you know, people come to watch us to make birdies and eagles. I don't think that's true. There's a reason people watch the U.S. Open, and people love to say to me during the weeks of the U.S. Open, I love watching these guys struggle. I love watching them make bogeys and doubles and have to be like me. Well, then it can't be both ways, right? It can be both ways, I mean. You can have an entertaining product that is extremely difficult, and you can have an entertaining product that is difficult but easier. Playing a PGA Tour golf course with a PGA Tour setup is not easy for anybody, even professionals. So you can vary the setup in different ways. And they could do this if they adopted this model local rule. They could come up with their own balls, and they could just make golf courses shorter. Or they could set up holes where players could still drive it in that deep part of the fairway or the part where it pinches or all that stuff and still leave them fundamentally the same clubs in. There's no reason they can't do that. And I don't think anyone would notice or really care. I just believe that. So I don't entirely understand where Justin Thomas is coming from here, but I think the thing that really bugged me was the whole 5-15 handicap amateur thing. It really doesn't apply. It's not relevant. I think it's a cheap shot. And he probably knows that, but I think that was a disappointing thing for me. But because he has been the most vocal person about this, I kind of wanted to talk about that because it goes over a lot of the common argument from people who are titleist players. You're from Webb Simpson. You're from Charlie Hoffman. Those guys are titleist players. You're going to hear a lot of the same reaction from those folks. I don't know if you're going to hear it as vociferously from players under other manufacturers' banners. I haven't heard anything from Callaway publicly. Bridgestone said, yeah, we're glad this isn't for everybody, and we're fine with making the best golf balls. We're going to continue to do that. I haven't seen a whole lot of reaction otherwise. So I get the sense that Titleist is obviously the driver here because they have the most to lose, right? The way they've marketed golf balls forever. I don't think that that's a losing proposition for them, by the way. They still make incredible golf balls, and I will say that repeatedly. They make incredible golf equipment, and it's incredible for anybody who wants to play it, regardless of whether it's a tour ball or not. They've already got patents for rolled back balls. They already make tour-specific formulations. All those things exist. So the argument that it's going to cost millions and bazillions of dollars to do this, I'm not very convinced of. Not to say that it will cost zero, but I will conclude with this, and this is an interesting theory I heard yesterday in a conversation I had with a couple folks. What if a manufacturer stepped up that this model local rule gets adopted and says, you know what? We will pay to be the exclusive manufacturer and provider of equipment for the ball side to PGA Tour players. We'll pay everybody. You'll get disbursements based on that. You're going to play our ball, but we're going to be the exclusive and be like every other major sport where there's a standard puck, there's a standard baseball, there's a standard football, there's a standard basketball. Those things are all standardized and they're bought. They're bought for by manufacturers to have just the one. And that I could see that happening in golf. It would be pretty expensive because obviously players get paid to use equipment and that includes balls. But if you made the price high enough, could you convince the PGA Tour to say, yes, we will happily take your money, Acushnet, Callaway, whatever. And from now on, for the next 5 years, we're playing this tour ball or these three tour balls made by this one manufacturer. I don't know if that's even plausible, but I thought it was an interesting theory, something to ruminate on as we kind of end the show here. Thanks for listening to Two Off the First. Hope you enjoyed this. I obviously am someone who is pro rollback here, but I can completely understand some of the arguments, and I can understand there's a rationale for many of them. I don't think the cheap shots are necessary, and I don't think the vagaries are necessary that Justin Thomas offered. So we're going to have next week. We haven't worked out all the details, but Lou Stagner, who does data for Arcos, and he's very much anti-rollback. We're going to have a conversation with him, but try to get a sense of his perspective on things and how he views the data, which is different, obviously, than I view the data. And we'll have a conversation about that because I want to present both arguments as articulately as possible. And obviously, having my point of view, I can't do that. So we'll have that here on the show in some fashion next week, TBD on all of that. Until then, I'm Ryan Balanji. Thank you for listening to the show. No visual version today. I'm going to go watch some NCAA tournament games. I hope you have a great time watching the tournament if you do, whether that's the NCAA, whether that's the Valspar, whatever it is, or both. And we will talk to you tomorrow. We'll have a visual version of the show along with the traditional voice version too. And we'll get into everything from the first round of the Valspar. We'll talk a little bit about, I'm sure, some other stuff that comes up in reaction to the rollback stuff and plenty more to talk about. And we'll be going over it all with you then. Thank you for listening. I will talk to you tomorrow. Have a great one, everybody.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.